This morning I want to talk about old King Ahab's bad idea. It's one of my favorite stories from when I was a kid. One of my favorite stories from the Bible. Ahab, just a bit of history. You know, I'm the history guy. And you know, after David was really the first king of Israel, and he was succeeded by his son Solomon. Solomon built Jerusalem. He built the temple. He built the palace. He started to construct the walls, but to do that, he heavily taxed the people, and he even enslaved them in some seasons in order to get the project done. And so after Solomon died and his son took the throne, his son listened to some bad advice, and instead of lightening the load on the people, he doubled the tax load. And so you thought your taxes were bad. He doubled the tax load, and there was a rebellion among the northern 10 tribes. So Israel split into two nations. You had Israel to the north, which were the 10 tribes up there, and then Judah, which were the two tribes in the south. So Ahab was the king in the northern kingdom. And his father was a man by the name of Omri. And Omri was a great warrior. He brought order to the 10 tribes, and he expanded their borders. He went to war in coalition, but led the coalition against the Assyrians, which was no small feat. A nation, of course, much bigger than his, and so he was well respected. And he was feared by people. And so when he died, his son Ahab took power. And as a means of solidifying his power, what he did, which was common in that time and place, was he made an alliance with another nation, and he did it through marriage. And so he made this alliance by marrying a woman named Jezebel, who was a Phoenician. And the Phoenicians lived over. They were kind of a seafaring people, and they lived over on the Mediterranean Sea, and they worshipped a god by the name of Baal, and they worshipped a goddess by the name of Asherah. And when Jezebel came to live in Ahab's kingdom, which was in the north in Samaria, wasn't in Jerusalem, it was in the north in Samaria, and it was centered, the holiest place in that part of the world was this place called Jacob's Well, which we see again in the New Testament when Jesus meets the Samaritan woman and he asks for a drink, and they have this long discussion about her wanting, if she would only follow him, she could drink from a well that would never end. Well, they were at the holiest site in the north, Jacob's Well. It was the well where reportedly Jacob of the Old Testament met his wife, met his father-in-law, and it was a well that never ran dry. And so anyhow, Ahab has this foreign wife. She brings in these foreign gods, and she convinces Ahab that his greatness doesn't come from the God of Israel, Yahweh, but rather that his greatness comes from Baal and from Asherah, and particularly Baal. Baal was a god of war. Baal was a god of life and death. And so she convinced him that Baal was on his side. And so as a part of that, he would get criticized by the prophets of Yahweh for not being faithful to the law, she advocated their death. As a matter of fact, there was a man in the court, as mentioned just briefly in the 20th verse, his name's Obadiah. He actually smuggles away 100 of the prophets of God and hides them in a cave and feeds them for a long period of time to preserve them from Jezebel's wrath. And so the nation is being torn apart, and people are living in fear, and they're being forced to worship a multitude of gods, and Ahab's just totally out of control. So here's the thing about Yahweh. You don't get to tell Yahweh what to do. You don't get to tell God what to do. God has His own will, and it's your job to figure out God's will and get on the right side of that, as opposed to Baal, who could be pushed around by Ahab. And so Ahab began to see himself as being more mighty and more powerful. He began to believe the hype that he would hear from people and from, you know, all of the yes men and that are in the court who just tell him what he wants to hear. It's a particular affliction of powerful people, and so he's got to listen to this endless. He listens to this all this endless praise, and pretty soon he thinks himself to be greater than God. It's amazing when we start listening to other voices about who we are, other than the Lord's. It can work both ways. You can have people who make you think you're greater than you are, but it can work, I think, probably just as often, if not more so, the other way. When was the first time you began to measure your worth by what other people told you about yourself? When was the first time someone told you you were smart or dumb? When was the first time you had somebody tell you that you were pretty or handsome or ugly? When was the first time someone told you you were fat? When was the first time you began? It's fun raising boys, because for the longest time, at least in our household, they don't care. They didn't care what they look like. I mean, every day I've got to make sure before they leave the house that some sort of soap and water has touched their body in the last 48 hours. And their hair can be going in 1,400 different directions. I have to remind them that every so often they need to drag a brush through their hair so that it, you know, it remains hair and doesn't become lead or something. And then there's this period of time, usually right around adolescence, that all of a sudden all my brushes in the house start to disappear. Because they're carrying them in their pocket, or they've migrated into their room, or they have 12 of them in their backpack. And when I see them, they're combing their hair, making sure that they're looking good, and they develop their own sense of style. They don't just pick up whatever's on the floor and throw it on in the morning. They actually begin to think about what they want to look like, and they're listening to what people are saying. When you start measuring your sense of self-worth by what other people told you about yourself, as opposed to what God had to say. Elijah, you know, here's the great thing about God. When the days are the darkest throughout the Bible, when the days are the darkest, God always seems to send the strongest leader in the midst of that darkness. And in this period where the prophets are being put to death and the future of Israel is kind of in doubt and there's this terrible king and queen in place, God sends this amazing prophet by the name of Elijah. He's so great that when Jesus comes, the debate is whether or not Jesus is the Messiah or if he's the return of the prophet Elijah. He's that big a figure in Jewish history and in the Bible. He's the greatest of all the prophets. So in this dark time, God sends Elijah, and he's not listening to what people are saying about Ahab, and he's not listening to what people are saying about the prophets. Even though it appears that the prophets of God are weak and they're being put to death, and Ahab is great and Baal is great, Elijah doesn't listen to any of that. Elijah understands who he is based upon the God who created him. How God has spoken to him defines who Elijah thinks he is. And so, even though Ahab has all the money, and Ahab has all the power, and Ahab has all the weapons, and Ahab has all the accolades, Elijah understands himself as being a child and a prophet of the living God, walking with him. And so Elijah just ends up walking into the court when it just seems like things couldn't get any worse. While they're killing prophets, Elijah walks into the palace of Ahab. It's pretty bold. Just walks into the palace. And he basically calls Ahab out. He says, listen, you have forgotten who we are as a people. You have forgotten how we are defined by the living God. And I do not believe that Baal is alive. I don't think Baal is anything more than a piece of stone or a piece of wood. And I'll prove it. Let's have a God-off. Right? It's a God-off showdown on the top of Mount Carmel. It's Yahweh versus Baal in the first ever God-off. And the prophets of Baal, who number of 450, they're going to be there. And they're going to build their own altar. And they're going to bring their own sacrifice. And they're going to call down fire out of the sky to take care of that sacrifice. And Elijah by himself, Elijah is going to show up and he's going to build an altar and he's going to provide a sacrifice and he's going to call down fire out of the sky. It's a mano y mano God off showdown at the OK Carmel. And so everybody shows up. Ahab, who believes the hype, and Elijah, who believes the Lord, doesn't believe what people say about him or what people say about Ahab. He believes about what God has said about each one of us and about him. And so the prophets of Baal build their altar and they put their sacrifice on it. And I wish there's I had a great Old Testament professor in seminary. His name was Robert Bauer. I actually took a lot of my Bible at the Josephinum Pontifical, which is a Roman Catholic school in Worthington. It's part of the Columbus Consortium of Theological Schools. There's a Lutheran school, a Catholic school, and a Methodist school. And you can take classes at any one of the three. And Father Bauer was an amazing Old Testament scholar. And the Hebrew, actually, when in 18, when Elijah is talking to the prophets of Baal, he says, I think I got it marked right here. I want to make sure I get this right. He's looking at the other prophets and he says, maybe your God is asleep. Maybe Baal is asleep because they're shouting and they're dancing and no fire is coming out of heaven. And so Elijah begins to taunt the prophets of Baal. And at one point he says, you know, maybe he's thinking. Here. Maybe he's deep in thought or busy or traveling. Deep in thought is not the only translation of the Hebrew. The better translation of the Hebrew is, maybe your God is on the toilet and he's busy right now. I mean, Elijah's talking smack. He's talking trash to the prophets of Baal. And so, of course, the fire doesn't come out of the sky, and then Elijah, who's got a flair, he's got a theatrical flair. Not only does he build his altar, not only does he butcher his sacrifice and put it on the altar, but he instructs the people to bring water to cover the altar. He builds a ditch around the altar so that it'll all be soaked. The water can't run away, and it'll be soaked with water. I think about Haiti when we go down there, and every water for all the projects has to be brought one bucket at a time. I just envision the people, you know, one bucket at a time, bringing up a water and dumping it on the altar. Just make it as wet and as non-flammable as you can. And then when it's time, Elijah does his thing. Fire comes down, and it not only burns up the altar and the sacrifice, but all the water and the dirt underneath of the water. And then he tells the people, these are false prophets, and they kill them. It's a great story. You got to believe what God has said about you. Not what the world has said about you. Max and I drove to Indianapolis yesterday. We watched a couple of indie movies in Indy. And one of the movies we watched was a documentary about Mr. Rogers, who was like one of my favorite people when I was little. And one of the things that Mr. Rogers said really upset him about television was that while his mission was to try and help children understand that the feelings that they had, that they were real, that they were important people created by the living God who had sacred worth to him, and what they felt and what they believed was valid, and he tried to help them understand this about themselves, was that he said most of the people who were producing children's programming just wanted to create new consumers. Make us feel like if we can buy this thing or get this thing, or if we don't look quite this way or we don't act quite like this, then maybe we'll be happy. Maybe we'll be better. We have to believe, not the voices around us, but the still small voice that speaks, that calls each one of us a child of God. The still small voice that speaks and says that each one of us has been created with opportunities to do important things in the life of the kingdom. That there are no gods or goddesses that can stand against you. That the powers and principalities of this world, that they come and that they go. But that the things that matter, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, goodness, faithfulness, self-control, this grace that we sang about earlier, this prevenient grace which will chase us up any mountain and run through any wall, that this is how we need to define ourselves going forward. And understand that this is who we are. That we've been fearfully and wonderfully made. And it's not that we're flawless people, and it doesn't mean that we don't have a responsibility, that we need to take the talents and gifts that have been given to us and develop those. But we are enough in and of ourselves. Each one of us is enough for the living God. Jesus died on the cross for each one of us. There was nobody excluded because they weren't good enough. And the circumstances of this life, sometimes we make mistakes and sometimes mistakes happen to us. But the reality is that God never stops loving us. So this is a truth that we need to hang on to. It was a truth that was at the heart of who Elijah was. It was the root of his power. Because he saw himself as a servant of God, which meant he was a servant of all people. Love your neighbor as yourself. What if you don't love yourself? Ever gone through a season where you didn't love yourself? That's a lie.
lie. A lie from the pit of hell. A deception. And see, on the other side of that, we need to be willing to proclaim this truth. Just as Elijah proclaimed the truth of the living God to the people who were living in Israel and out into the world, you and I need to proclaim this truth about Jesus Christ too. Jesus Christ came so that each one of us would know life. And that each one of us has gifts and graces that have been placed in us. But He came to die for us, and we're enough. Now we get the opportunity to use these gifts and graces in the service of His kingdom. We need to share the story of God's love for all His people. I've already alluded to Max. One of the Max is working at a freedom school here in Lima. It's a school that's working primarily with at-risk kids, and the focus is on part of it's literacy and promoting reading and a love of reading. Part of it is helping kids understand that God wants to do amazing things through them. And he was telling me about how kids in his class, he works with 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, how many of these kids will define themselves as the, quote, problem child, unquote. Who do you think told them they were the problem child? Teachers? Administrators? Other kids? Parents? He said, "Dad, I only have six weeks, and during those 6 weeks, I need to help these kids believe in themselves, believe in the possibilities that exist for their life, believe that anything is possible for them, and that they're not a problem. They're an opportunity. They're a gift." See, this is what we need to shout from the mountaintops. This is what we need to let people know. That God loves them just the way they are. And when we get the opportunity to be in a relationship with the living God through the living Christ, we can discover so much more about who we are and what God has for us as He seeks to use us in the lives of others, while even at the same time He repairs these pains that we've picked up along the way when we've been rejected by people and we've been lied to about who we are. You are fearfully and wonderfully made. But you have a responsibility to make sure that other people know that too. Because God is great. And He's great because He's love. And He's called us to love our neighbor as ourselves. And we can't love our neighbor if we don't love ourselves.